are coming out to hear Ohio Women in the Civil War. I'm the curator here at the Rosenelnik Medical Museum, and I hope if you haven't already, you take some time to look through the exhibits after the presentation. I'd like to take a minute to thank our co-sponsors, the Women's Studies Program at YSU, who provided the refreshments, and the Ohio Historical, or no, I'm sorry, the Mahoning Valley Historical Society. The program tonight is part of the Ohio Humanities Council Speakers Bureau and the Ohio Civil War 150 celebration. Now to introduce our speaker for tonight. Kelly Selby is an assistant professor at Walsh University, where she teaches U.S. Civil War and Women's History. She received her BA in History from Baldwin Wallace College and her Master's in Public History from Kent State University. Selby pursued her research interests in the history of 19th century war and society at Kent State University, earning her PhD in 2008 with her dissertation, The 27th United States Colored Troops, Ohio Soldiers and Veterans. She recently served on the Civil War 150 Interpretive Committee for the Ohio Historical Society and just joined the Ohio War of 1812 Commission's Educational Working Group. Please welcome Dr. Selby.
Well, I'd like to reiterate the thank yous in the opening to all of these organizations that have helped make tonight possible. The Ohio Humanities Council has been working very hard to support the Civil War 150, so it's very nice to see local organizations as your museums and your university also supporting this sesquicentennial event that we're trying to spread to the masses. We're trying to commemorate the Civil War in a way that helps reach out and make sense to more than simply those Civil War historians, or buffs as some people like to call us. We really would like to include everybody, and so tonight's talk is one of the directions the Interpretive Committee really felt strongly about sharing. The idea that women did participate, and we should talk about that, especially in light of today's world when women are a key part of our military events and actions. I also like to thank Cassie for arranging, where'd she sneak out, arranging everything this evening. All right. I came to this topic as a graduate student at Kent State working on my master's. And I was fascinated by this idea of how did war affect society and how did society affect war. And I lived in Lorain County and spent a great deal of time in Oberlin, which is a community that has a lot of Civil War ties. And I came upon a journal that was kept by a woman during the Civil War, and I thought, this is great. This, I am going to find out what was going on. And I had the transcribed copy. So I located the donor. They still had the original, so it was wonderful. I was able to get a hold of the original and use it. Kind of the bad part is she never talked about the war in 4 years, which really threw me for a loop. But after you dug through it, you could see where the war really still was affecting her life. And so it ends up helping me make the stronger argument about the effect of war on society and society has on war. But I kind of put her away, and then when I worked on my PhD, I wanted to pursue the same question, but I was much more interested in another group of Ohioans, free black men who fought in the Civil War. And it wasn't until this last year when I was on the Interpretive Committee for Civil War 150 when I brought the Civil War women back out. And I have to say I'm really glad. I'm really enjoying revisiting them. So tonight I'm going to share with you a little bit about this topic. And what I'm hoping to convince you is the true significance of the women's role during the Civil War. For historians, it took quite a while to start looking at this. And if any of you have seen some of the textbooks from about 20 years ago, the way that they dealt with it was to stick a picture of a lady in the corner of the textbook, right? With a little heading underneath that said something. And that's just not quite enough, all right? There is a true relationship between the ability of Northern women to help and the inability of Southern women to help that has an effect on the outcome of the Civil War. So we don't have to just stick women up in the corner. We can have a true discussion of their importance. And that's where Ohio comes in for us, is I can show you, I hope, the significance of what Northern women could do. And Ohio is a perfect state. Again, we don't have to exaggerate Ohio's role in the American Civil War. So let's start off with what most people think about when they, maybe we will, let's see how this is gonna work. What do most people think of, and maybe you're not that audience, but let's be realistic. When we talk about the Civil War to Americans, that beautiful woman up there in the corner is the first to come to light, right? Who's that? How realistic is this about women in the Civil War? How many women were like Scarlett? Hardly any, yeah. I mean, less than 25% of Southerners owned slaves. It's something like 0.1% that actually owned the kind of slaves that Scarlett's family had. Listen, that movie is great for what it says wrong about the Civil War. That's how I like to use it. I'm not saying it's not good. It's fun. I enjoyed watching it. I still watch it occasionally. But, you know, it just didn't look like Scarlett, okay? That does disservice to the women on an everyday basis. But we'll still bring back her movie in a minute, okay? We don't want to completely shut out Scarlett. How about the woman down in the lower corner here?
Harriet Tubman.
Harriet Tubman played an incredibly important role during the Civil War, not before. Most of us know her from the Underground Railroad work. But what did she do during the Civil War?
Was it a hospital work?
She might have done a little bit of that, but her major contribution.
Didn't she bring slaves up through the Underground?
She did before the Civil War, yeah, and that's what made her so valuable. She knew the ways to go between.
A spy?
She was a scout and a spy for the Union Army. She was employed by the Northern Army to help them get reconnaissance and information on the Southern troops. After the war, she's denied any recognition or pension of this. It isn't until she marries a veteran, and when he passes away, she gets his widow's pension. But she's denied a pension for her own service. This woman made an incredible contribution, but how many Northern women are doing this? Very, very few, okay? You just don't have. Now, there were a number of women early in the war that were passing information back and forth because they could hide it in their dresses. How could they get away with that in 1861, 1862?
Yeah, bustles.
Yeah? Yeah? Put it here, put it there. Why don't the guys look? You did not touch a woman that wasn't your wife or anything, you know, that even if she was the supposed enemy. Now, sometime about the middle of the war, they dropped that because they knew what they were doing and they let that social kind of context go. But I'm talking about this kind of activity where she's actually giving directions. She knows the way around these territories. Very valuable. We're not going to not put her in the history books. But she just isn't a true representation of what the biggest contribution was, what's really going on that's going to have an impact on the outcome of the war. How about this interesting set of photographs over here?
Same person.
It's the same person. Yes, it is. It's a woman who dresses up like a man so she can fight, right? The most recent book out, and if you happen to know, you can correct me, about 300 to 400 women have been documented to have fought in the Civil War, to dress like a man and to fight. Now, we had over 300,000 Ohio men go, just 300,000 Ohio men. What contribution do 300 women make? They don't have any real impact. Most of them don't go out and actually fight. Some of them did. This person here, they went back home after the war and continued to dress like a man. They didn't discover that it was a woman until she passed away. They had treated her as a veteran. This is the type of person I don't know what word you would use in the 19th century. We didn't have the terms that we have today for this, but she wanted to dress like a man. That was what she believed that she should dress like. Most of the women did it because it was a way to escape home, to have adventure. Some were just plain patriotic. Others found it a good way to move amongst the troops without being noticed when they did their business, right? A couple of them they discovered when they had babies, so. are they making a contribution to the military victory? You know, so we can talk about them, we can learn a lot about women, we can learn a lot about social roles, but when it comes down to that question of the Civil War and what role women played that may have had a real impact, these just aren't the ones that we should focus on all of our attention. Let's give them attention, but not all of our attention. Ohio has some women that do not play those types of roles and make more of a real effort, make a real impact in the Civil War era. Harriet Beecher Stowe was living in Cincinnati when she wrote what?
Uncle Tom's Cabin.
And, you know, people in the South were not very happy with her. We're pretty sure she used some information she learned from neighboring communities in Brown and Adams County, as well as what she witnessed in Cincinnati, to write up her accounts. No, she'd never been to the South, but she had witnessed some, or had talked to people who had witnessed some of these events. What did Lincoln supposedly say when he met her?
This is the little lady that started this big war.
So this is the little lady that started this big old war. And some people say, well, that really didn't happen. Well, it doesn't matter. That is the image that comes across to some people. She published the book in 52 or 53. It started as a newspaper weekly, and then it was published. It had an incredible impact on dividing the North and the South. Not her intent. War wasn't her intent, of course, but ending slavery was. So here's a woman that fits in with the genre of other abolitionists or anti-slavery women. And the book is a recent book published on Quaker women. Ohio had a significant Quaker population. Quakers were the first to actively work against slavery in this country in an organized manner. And that's what these women are doing in Ohio behind the scenes. They certainly didn't want war. What's the belief of the Quakers?
They're pacifists.
They're pacifists, so they certainly did not want it to end in warfare. They believe your moral understanding of the world should end slavery. But once the war breaks out, they're going to take their energy to help the freedmen. After the war, they're going to help educate. So these are a group of Ohio women that are clearly giving the support for what ultimately becomes the cause of the civil, or excuse me, the outcome of the Civil War. How about the lady down here in the bottom, Martha McCook? Anybody know who that might be? Yeah, you've heard of them. She had 9 sons go off to fight. And then her husband's brother's family sent another 8, I believe. Okay, there's what's in Ohio. A lot of Ohio women sent their husbands, brothers, sons, fathers off to war. Most did not send 9 off. Okay, she, again, is kind of this exaggerated example. But Ohio served at the at least at the per population rate than any of the other northern states. We were the third largest, but we had actually more soldiers. All right, how about on the very far side there, the statue? This Ohio woman. It's actually though in Indiana, the statue.
Clara Barton.
Not Clara Barton, but she did the same kind of work.
Dorothea Dix.
She was born in Knox County, Mount Vernon, Ohio. Mother?
Bickerdike.
Mary Ann Ball Bickerdike, right? They always have all these long names for me. But they called her mother. Yes, she was a nurse. She was born in Mount Vernon, and she attended Oberlin College for a while. She married and moved then to Illinois with her husband, Illinois or Indiana. And when the war broke out, she was a widow. And so she went to help nurse the troops. And I say help to nurse. Nursing is not a profession yet. So Clara Barton was a nurse, but she wasn't a capital N nurse, right? Marianne Bickerdyke was with Grant and later Sherman's troops, and she was with Sherman on his famous, or infamous if you're from the South, March to the Sea. What'd he say about her?
She ranks me.
She ranks me. Okay, saying that in the 19th century is a pretty big deal about a woman, okay? But what was going on is she was aware, like other women, Clara Barton was one example of this, that had learned a lot from Florence Nightingale. Florence Nightingale had served in a nursing capacity during the Crimean War and had argued that cleanliness and better food and fresh air would help the troops. Well, they don't have this kind of germ theory knowledge at the time. She only had her own eyes as her evidence of what helped for the men. And Marianne Bickerdyke, Clara Barton, some others had read about what she had argued, and they're going to apply this. And when Sherman saw that his troops were, some of them, getting better, or at least not getting worse, he said, let that lady do whatever she wanted. Okay? But why is she mother? These nurses didn't just wrap your elbows and change your clothes.
Oh, they were like a habit.
But what did they do with the young men?
They listened, they comforted, they basically were stood in as mother.
Yes, or wife in a generic sense, or sister. Absolutely. They acted as a woman would have at home when they would comfort a sick person. That's basically what a lot of their nursing. There were women that had more medical skill, but most of them are acting in that female capacity of the time. They were the caregiver. And that's where she gets this name, mother. The boys called her mother. Sherman didn't care what they called her as long as they got better. And he said, just let them. So these Ohio women really are more evidence of what a larger number of women are doing. We have over 10,000 easily women that are nursing. You have women in the Civil War era writing this prescriptive literature. You have Quakers all over, at least in the northern and the central states, and you have mothers, again, sending their sons off. So we don't have to exaggerate or find this image of a woman out there that there was only one that did this. We have significant evidence of true contribution during the war. And I would say nursing is probably one of the more important contributions. I'm talking more about the home front today, so I'm not going to talk a lot about the nurses, but Ohio did send its fair share off. I think if we really want to come down to this question of how did Northern women help to victory and Southern women unable to help lead to Confederate defeat, we have to look at the home front. Because this is where most of the activity took place that's going to alter the outcome or the potential outcome for the war. So up here in the corner, what's this woman doing on my side? Yeah, she is taking over, and you see the little daughter too. They're replacing the husband and the brothers and the fathers. Now, women would have worked out in somewhat of an agricultural capacity in a kitchen garden or helping to preserve food and things like that. But the real heavy agricultural labor, if you lived somewhere and you had help, women would not have been doing that. Again, it depends if you're in a real remote area and you're very poor, then you're out there. But most women wouldn't have been appropriate for them to be doing the larger field work. The Civil War breaks out, and these women are going to go do any work that they can to keep these farms going. How did the Army pay end up for most of those privates and even some of the non-commissioned officers? What was the pay like?
$13 a month.
Yeah, very low, right? Very low, and you don't get paid every week or every month. You got paid when the paymaster found your company of your regiment. You could go 6 months or a year waiting for the paymaster. Some people, Ohio was very fortunate. We had a system set up where money could be sent back to your congressional district and held for you if you approve that. But there are a number of women, a lot of women, that simply don't have access to regular funds. And so these women are literally taking over the farms. They are taking over businesses. They are taking over work decisions about property. And you can read this in tens of thousands of letters where they're writing back and forth. You know, Bob, what do you want me to do about that account up at Mr. Smith's bank? And he tells her in the letter what he wants her to do. Or a young man in the 27th is sending money home every time he gets it to his mother, and she's putting it down on some land that he wants to buy. But the land that she's going to purchase it for him while he's gone. So these women are stepping outside of what would have normally been acceptable roles, and they're going to fill, keep the home fires burning. That's the term we might want to use here. That's what most women are doing, okay? That's what most women are doing. So those husbands, fathers, sons could go off to war, do their duty to their country, or in the case of some Ohioans, they were drafted and forced to go, and they would come back knowing that their lives might resume close to what they had been. How about over here in this corner? A little hard to see, but what's the little one doing?
Crying.
Yeah, these people are mourning, and they're in black dress. They're mourning, and boy, this was a responsibility of women in the mid-19th century. Mourning was a very feminine-focused activity. And so when you went to church or you heard one of the speeches in town, the mayor or what have you would be calling on the women to send their men to war, even if it meant they wouldn't come home. Men fought war, women sent men to war. So if you really loved your family, you would send your sons off, that Mrs. McCook. 9 of them, right?
How many survived, do you know?
Of her sons, actually of the 17, there were 9 and 8. Of the 17, I think only 3 died. Does anybody familiar with the McCooks? Some were injured, so when they came back, if they died right away or after that, I wouldn't know that cut off. Several were officers. Several, when they came back to Ohio, took prominent roles. And then there were those that, you know, fought just like the average guy and didn't do nothing. But I think there were 3 of the 17 that died during the war. But nonetheless, this was something that they were called upon to do for their country. They couldn't, like the woman in the previous slide, they shouldn't, put on the men's clothing and pick up a gun. This was how they fought, by sending off. And mourning at the time was very, I suppose today is socially constructed to how we mourn, what's appropriate, but their rules were much more rigid. So if we go to our Gone with the Wind example, what does Scarlett get in trouble for when her husband dies,
She
went dancing. Yeah, she didn't want to wear that black mourning dress as long. She ripped the hat off. I can't remember the exact scene, but she's not playing by the rules. You know, an appropriate woman would have honored, especially during wartime, that mourning period. You had things like black-lined stationery. There was this whole material culture of mourning, and women really held the heaviest burden of this. So it's not that men didn't mourn, but they had a less visual role in that. So when they sent the men away to die, they were the role of mourning for that person. In the diary I mentioned that I used for my master's thesis, she talked about death weekly, if not almost daily. People died, it seemed more frequently to us in the 19th century. Death was a more common companion, if you will. She only mentioned one soldier's death in 4 years. And I just was flabbergasted by this. And it was a friend had come over and showed the picture, the daguerreotype of her brother who had just died. It's the only thing she's more interested in than the picture. But that's all she ever, there's only soldiers she talked about. And yet people died all the time. Mrs. So-and-so died. The child of so-and-so died. She was like a little journalist for the community. And I know the soldiers were dying in Oberlin, by the way, because I'd read the newspapers and I was waiting to find her talking about them. So she didn't follow this quite as closely, but her mourning was more on a very, personal level. All right, the big thing, though, what I really want to focus on to make this argument about the women's contribution is this circle down here. And it's not very large. I go larger later, but what can you tell what those ladies are doing?
Sewing.
Okay, what do you think they're sewing?
Uniforms.
Yeah, they're doing something for soldiers, whether it's clothing, whether it's hospital supplies. When the war breaks out, And again, women aren't expected to go serve. And even early in the war, they weren't expected to be nurses. Men were the first hospital orderlies and things like that. What was expected or what was acceptable was to do the things they would have done for their soldier if he was at home. You made their food, you made their clothing, you took care of them when they were sick, and you watched their moral behavior. Well, if they're not there with you, you can still do these things by making clothes, wrapping bandages, sending Bibles, etc. And so women start to do this immediately. Some of the accounts which we'll read, they start by making the regimental or the company flags, right? And you can read this in every newspaper that the ladies of town came and gave them their flags. And this is very appropriate that they would sew this, right? That they would use fabric and create this. And then again, with the whole ceremony, they're sending their men off. They're turning their men over to the government to serve their duty. But very soon it becomes clear they need more than flags. So after Fort Sumter in April of 61, Lincoln made that first call. He wanted 13,000 men from Ohio. How many men showed up that weekend or week or whatever? About 30,000. Those men in Ohio, they're ready to go, like every other state, by the way. But they didn't need 30,000. So first they're sending some of them home. But the other problem is, where'd they go? What do you have in April of 61 in Ohio to take care of 13,000 men who are going to become soldiers? What do you have? You have nothing. This country has a long history from the colonial period up until the World War II era of having a small standing army. We believe in using the citizen volunteer, the militia, today the National Guard. And we have this very strong and long understanding that that's the appropriate way. And if there is an event, a serious event in which you need help, you put the call out like Lincoln did, and the men will come and do their duty. And so there's nowhere for these men to go. They're showing up in Cleveland and Columbus and Cincinnati. We're here. What are we going to do with you? We don't have anywhere to put you. We don't have anything to give you to wear, any food. So what do the ladies do? In Cleveland, they went on a blanket drive. They went door to door collecting blankets and quilts so these guys could bed down in the park in the, you know, soon-to-be camp that was going to be used to train them. The New York ladies claimed they did it first, but I think the evidence is there that the Cleveland ladies were first. I'm gonna work to just make them change that. By one day, I think the Cleveland ladies beat them. But anyway, this is going to start happening all over, and small communities, large communities, cities, where the women collect the things that are needed until the government can catch up, the state and federal, can catch up to how you house these men, train them, and send them off. Well, this is going to fit very nicely. It's not going to be difficult for these women to organize this, because in the decades before the Civil War, we go through what we call our first reform era in the United States. Reform meaning trying to improve or make things better. And so you had people that belonged to groups that tried to slow down drinking, the temperance movement. You had people that wanted to see more public education, so we had educational reform. You had people who were concerned about prostitution, so you had moral societies. After World War XII, the very first reform society was a peace society. They were going to see to it that man never had war again. How'd that work? The big ones, though, we start to have a women's rights movement and the very biggest of the reforms, anti-slavery. And each one of these areas, and there are many more, had clubs. You could belong in your community to one of these societies. In Ohio, you could belong to the Youngstown Anti-Slavery Society, the Ohio Anti-Slavery Society, and the American Anti. There were local, state, and federal or national groups. And so you could be very involved in these. Maybe in your 20s you cared about prostitution, and maybe in your 40s you were more into ending slavery. Or maybe you were a member of both the whole time. But many people were consumed by this, including women. So when the war breaks out, they're already used to meeting and talking about problems and what can we do to solve them. And so when the war breaks out, you're going to see women like this be organized under what they will call soldiers' aid societies. So in Cleveland, you're going to see a group of women gather and call themselves the Northern Ohio Soldiers Aid Society. But most went by their city names, okay? So Canton would have several. Akron, Youngstown, Cleveland area came together, so you'd have to go further west to the Elyria and the Sandusky, for example. And then you can go southward. These are all over the state, thousands of these groups. Some communities had more than one. What also is very interesting about these groups, like many of the reform groups, they tended to be ecumenical. So you could have the Women's Presbyterian Soldiers Aid Society, but generally you had women crossing religious lines to join together for this cause. And that was happening in a lot of the reform groups as well in Ohio. So they would meet once a week, somebody's house, the church possibly, and they would sew the quilts and the shirts, they would roll the bandages and can the peaches. They all canned peaches. I don't know where they got them, but there were always canning peaches in Ohio. And they would make little sewing kits, they would collect Bibles, and then they wanted them sent off to their sons, husbands, and brothers, because that's what they would do. And the problem was the federal government really didn't have the capacity to take all of these soldiers, especially after the second call, when Lincoln in July puts out a second call for men. How are you gonna clothe these men and take care of them? So these women are acting in a way that was acceptable before the war in these reform movements. Now they're transitioning that to taking care of these men because, one, it's what women do, and two, it's because the federal government is having trouble getting its act together. I mean, we didn't have the administrative type of government that we have today, the size of the government. It wasn't set up for that. So the Northern Ohio Soldiers Aid Society, here what we see is in January of 64, they received from the Norwalk Union Soldiers Aid Society two boxes of hospital stores, okay? So Cleveland is going to become a center for collecting all of this stuff. Cincinnati is the other area, and we'll pop them up in a minute, that is going to collect from these boxes, from these thousands of groups. So let's say we have one of these societies and we've collected all of this material for the soldiers. How do we get there?
Railroad?
As women sitting in my house. Right? I mean, what are we going to, can we load up a wagon and take it ourselves? Mm-hmm. Where are the soldiers? Once they leave Cleveland and Cincinnati to go fight. Hard telling, one, but they're mostly in the South, right? Mostly, not all. We have some out in the Western Theater, and we have some hanging around and waiting to go and come back, etc. But most of the soldiers are somewhere in the war theater that is taking place largely in the South. Not appropriate for women to load up their wagon and take their supplies out. So what's going to happen in the background is an organization is going to develop, and I think I have something else first I do. Let's come back to that. What's going to happen in the background to this is a group of very prominent men from New York City are going to recognize that the U.S. Army is in no way ready to take care of the medical needs of the soldiers. If real war breaks out, they're going to be in trouble. Now, as an aside, what kind of medical training do we have in 1860 in this country?
4 weeks.
If they're lucky. Yeah? They called themselves, go ahead.
Apprenticeships.
Apprenticeships, yeah. They called themselves surgeons. That's quite a statement. Right? The regiment that I studied, there was a young man, I think he was like 22, and he had a condensed course so he could get out of college to come. This is scary stuff, right? Well, to us, to them, that would be a trained person, okay? And anyway, this is a group photo of some of the earliest members of the United States Sanitary Commission. These were men that were really worried about the health, especially the medical needs of soldiers. And so they go to Abraham Lincoln and they say, "Would you accept help from a civilian wing? We don't want to join your army. We don't want to be part of your government. We're not asking for any money. We want to organize civilians to help." And Lincoln was a smart man, but it would take a smart person to say yes to that, right? I'll take any help we can get. And so the United States Sanitary Commission is this group of men who sought donations and materials that then could be shipped and sent to the hospitals, the Union hospitals. It also had, as part of its belief, to help the soldiers' families at home. I've not found a lot of what they did for them. I think the concentration was very much on a daily basis going to soldiers. So at the same time these women are starting to make all these things, you have this group of men, connected men. One of the guys was a Harvard science professor. Another one was a physician from New York City. Another was a reverend. They were all different religions. You had a Unitarian, you had a Catholic, you had a Presbyterian. So, I mean, that ecumenical part of that is even here in this organization. But at the same time the women are collecting all of these and creating all these supplies, this group of men offer Lincoln to be that body that gets it to the soldiers. And so what they do is they set up these branches of the United States Sanitary Commission. Now this is an actual photograph of one of the stations in D.C. It's not a branch per se, it's one of their main offices. Operating out of New York City isn't going to do them any good, right? Because most of the soldiers are in the D.C. and area and south. But nonetheless, what you're going to see is Cleveland will get one of these branch stations and Cincinnati. So if you lived in Ohio, if we divided the state kind of cross from Toledo down to Marietta, imagine, anybody north of that line or above that line sent their stuff usually to Cleveland. The people below the line tended to send to Cincinnati. And so they would get their husbands or the local delivery guy or even some of the local trains would take these stores then to these headquarters. And then women at those headquarters would box it up and the mail organization would arrange for it where they went. Okay, so they would tell these ladies, we need you to put them on a train to the Army of the Potomac. We need you to send one down to the Western Theater. We need one down in Mississippi. And they would tell these ladies where to send it. And then they had a relationship with the railroads, reduced fares, and they made sure the supplies got to the Union soldiers. So let's go back for a moment and see what a group of ladies put in the newspaper in 1863, what they had collected for that time they were going to make the donation. And women did this either monthly, weekly, however big their group was. But you don't have to read all of them, but they make 91 shirts, right? 65 pairs of drawers, pocket handkerchiefs, 138 pillow slips, pillow sheets, towels, socks, mittens, compresses, rolled bandages, rolls, papers. Look at all the stuff that's going to be used in the hospital here, the clothing and all of the supplies. And then you get down to some of the food. Crackers, toast, pickles, vinegar, canned fruit, 42 bushels of apples. And then you go on, and then you see at the bottom the total estimated value, their money, $225. Okay? Their money. With this last couple years, the money value, I won't begin to guess anymore, but it used to be about 13 to get today's money. Okay? About. So that's a significant amount of donations from one group of ladies in Knox County, Ohio. Thousands of these were in Ohio collecting things. And what's really fun for us is these ladies like to tell everybody what they did. And they like to outdo the next community. And so they're in the newspaper all the time. Okay? It was it was patriotic, but there was competition involved. We wanted your community to give more than other communities. And they'll pick up on this later in the war as well. But this is the kind of stuff they would have made or collected at home anyway. So leaving the house to go to one of these meetings or one of these get-togethers was quite appropriate. It also served as a place where you could do that morning with people who would understand, right? If Sally had just found out her husband wasn't coming home and she couldn't really go out in proper society, she could hang out with the ladies and mourn properly and help other women's families. So it really had a lot of layers of meaning at these Soldiers' Aid Societies. Now, again, what's happening is they're collecting them. Their men are making sure they get sent to the branches. At the branches, the United States Sanitary Commission is telling the women at the branches where to send them. There's a great deal of control in male hands, even though the ladies are making all of this stuff. One of the problems with that is you start to see letters about mid in the war where Johnny's writing home to Mary that he still hasn't got a single pair of socks she knitted. And she told him she'd been knitting socks every week at the meeting. Maybe she should stop going to the meeting and knit him socks, right? Or my regiment heard about the fine apples the people of Knox County sent. We haven't got one of them. Can you make sure the Knox County socks go to Knox County boys? No. The United States Sanitary Commission sends the supplies where they're most needed. So if the Cleveland ladies are collecting multiple quilts and they're needed by a regiment or an army, where no Ohioans are, that's where they're going to go. So there was a little bit of tiff about that with some of the men. They didn't like that they weren't getting mommy stuff or whatever. The other problem was there was a lot of accusations that the doctors in the hospitals were taking out the first pick of some of the items, claiming that the young men that were sick weren't getting the food. And you saw a lot of this being accused. But in the end, a lot of people really believed that most of the supplies did get to the soldiers. It tended to be, you read a lot about the areas where there was a particular group of men that overstepped their boundaries. So this is going on all over the state of Ohio. Multiply that money by 4 years, by thousands of societies. And you're going to get a significant amount of war materials. Food and clothing are needed for soldiers. They're war materials, and they're being provided by these women. Now, 63-64, how's the war going in the North? For the North. Not in the North, for the North. Union troops aren't doing very well, right? They're not getting the victories they thought they might get. And you're starting to have some trouble. The recruiting has gone down. They've resorted to the draft. You also, though, have women whose husbands have been gone for several years now, either because they are still enlisted or they've passed away. And in the North, you're going to see, despite the economic growth because of the wars, the government's requirement of Ohio's agriculture and industry, individuals like these women are finding themselves without things to donate anymore. So a woman in Chicago is going to get an idea that they needed a break from rolling just plain bandages, and maybe they could use their skills to make fancier needlework and have a bazaar. That this was something that women had been doing, again, decades before the Civil War, as a way to raise money for churches, anti-slavery cause, and they knew how to run a bazaar, they knew how to, you know, sell the goods and make a little bit of money. Why wouldn't they do that for the war effort? Since things weren't going too well, and you're running out of, you know, peaches to can and things like that, let's go ahead and take a break and make some nicer things and then have kind of a bazaar where people can come and forget a little bit about what's going on. And so in Chicago, they're going to be very successful. And women in Ohio are very interested. Women from Cincinnati and Cleveland go to Chicago to the fair. And they come back to Ohio and say, we can do that. We can do that. And so here is a poster from Cincinnati's. It was called the Great Western Sanitary Fair, and this started in late December of 63. Its official ending was in January, but some parts of it continued for several more months. It wasn't just a bazaar like a church bazaar. These things were grand events. These were the things like when you go to the IX Center in Cleveland for a car show or a sportsman show. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It was that big. Okay, you had people come in to witness or view the newest machinery that the Cincinnati merchants were making. There was a whole merchants and mechanics wing. You had people, and this again, kind of dark. We don't have good photographs at this time. This is a drawing, but it's artwork. You didn't have the free art museums yet, and so wealthy individuals would allow their art to go on display, and the common man could come in and pay the 10 cents or whatever and see the artwork. And then at the end of the fair, you'd take your artwork back home. You had restaurants in the fair. You had music, plays, speeches. Cleveland had a centerpiece that was like a rainforest. I mean, they had tropical plants and birds, okay? But you would pay to get in a small amount, and then you'd have access. Oh, another wing would have curiosities and oddities. And one of the favorite things was to see the mini balls in the barks of wood, or hand-carved bone and wood from prison camps. Abraham Lincoln rewrote the Emancipation Proclamation 5 times to donate to some of these places. So I mean, it was an entertainment extravaganza in the 1860s, and people came and had fun. They were being patriotic because their money went to the soldiers, but they were having fun. And then there was the room where the ladies had their fancy needlework, the bazaars. So Cleveland, and again, very poor artwork that we have, drawings from the fair itself. I mean, but you can see the flags are up. This is very patriotic. You're not going to forget that there's a war going on. But also, you have all of this greenery, and it looks all decorated and beautiful, and the women from each one of the Soldiers' Aid Societies could have their own booth to raise money. In Cleveland, there was this magnificent, beautiful quilt, and they auctioned it off, and it created quite a scandal in Cleveland, because some people thought that, you know, buying tickets and auctioning was quite sinful. So the man that ended up winning it donated it to be auctioned again so it would get more money for the soldiers. In other words, what are you worrying about an auction in a moment like this, right? But this went on, these went on for weeks. So the Northern Ohio Sanitary Fair was in February of 64 until March. Do you know what it's like in Cleveland in February? And they had that room with the birds and the plants, and they had a special room for the ladies because it was so warm they would faint. Okay? So this was a extravaganza of fun. The railroads gave discounts to passengers. Okay? So while the ladies are organizing this, while the ladies have realized we can make money from the entrance fee, we can make money from selling food, we can make money from our fancy needlework, how do you set up buildings this big? And by the way, Cleveland's was over Public Square, and it had like 5 branches that went out. It was right over the roads. Who has to do this? Men. And so local businessmen donated the lumber. Local businessmen paid their workers, but then gave them the day to go build the buildings. Okay? Local businessmen owned railroads and things like that that gave the reduced fee. So while the women did all of the decorating and sat there and made the fancy work, this was really a very cooperative venture. And like the ladies who liked to put in the newspaper who made more quilts, the men in each one of these cities tried to do the other men. What kind of a building, how many of your manufacturing inventions you're showing, and things like that. These became very civic engagements. Now, Cleveland grossed over $100,000 their month. Their bazaar grossed over $100,000. Incredible. Cincinnati grossed over $200,000. They didn't stop when the fair ended. When the fair ended, they dismantled the buildings and sold the materials. So the ladies in Cleveland sold their buildings to the Pittsburgh ladies, who then put it up for their fair. Do you think they gave the money back to the guy that donated the wood?
No.
No, it went in their treasury to help buy fabric and food so that you could keep those meetings going, so you could get what the men needed. Well, remember who's really over all of this? The men back in United States Sanitary Commission, and they're waiting for all this cash to come in. They've got plans, and they're writing letters dutifully to these women, and you can read these in the Western Reserve Historical Society. Mrs. Rouse, Rebecca Rouse, was the most important woman in Cleveland working at the Northern Ohio Soldiers' Aid Society. Mrs. Rouse, when are you going to be forwarding that money from the fair? Mrs. Rouse, we saw in the newspapers that you grossed over $100,000. When are you sending that money? We have a lot of things we need to buy. You know what the lady said? That's our money. We're not giving it to you. Now, technically, the women in each one of these branches had a male on the account, the bank account. Mark Hanna from Cleveland was on the women's account in Cleveland. Luckily, he was a nice guy and understood, and he said, yeah, we'll keep our money here. What did they do? They took the money and bought fabric from Northern Ohio businessmen. They bought food, beef, other supplies from Northern Ohio businessmen. So then that stuff was turned into the products and sent to the soldiers. So you see, this was a very, as much as it was patriotic, it was also about helping people here as well. And the men in New York did not like this at all. They thought they were just going to get handed the cash and then they would contact their buddies to buy all of this stuff. But nonetheless, by the time we, I wanted to show you one more thing too about the Cleveland Fair. In Cleveland, they were actually given franking privileges. So they set up a post office. And if you went to the fair, you took your mail there, and the ladies got the money for the stamp, but the post office still delivered it. Okay? And so today, stamp collectors love these. I guess they're worth a lot of money if it came from one of the sanitary fairs. It wasn't just Cleveland, other fairs did this as well. But yeah, you just send your mail off, but the money stayed to go to the soldiers. So they're very creative, these ladies, in finding ways to raise the funds. But by the end of the war, what we see happening is, Northern women raise literally millions of $1860 in supplies that went to Union soldiers. Millions. In clothing, in hospital stores, in Bibles, in anything that they would have done at home. What about Southern women? Didn't they care about their husbands and brothers and sons in their hospitals? Sure they did. And early in the war, they tried to do some of these same things. They created little groups. There were, the Southerners called them petticoat gunboats, where women would collect money to build gunboats that would protect some of the river cities against invasion. What's the scene in Gone with the Wind when Melanie's at the ball? They're raising money for the soldiers. What does she donate? Her wedding ring. How many wedding rings do you have? Once she gave it, she had nothing else to give. Before the war breaks out in the South, they look like they're a rich area, but they're very cash poor. Their money is in slaves' property, and what are they producing?
Cotton.
Cotton is the number one export of the whole United States. You can't eat cotton. Could they sell it to get money? They tried, but there's that blockade in place, and while it's not the greatest, it's working, okay? So they can't send the cotton out to get money to help them, but they also can't get enough supplies to come in. So they're low in food, they're low in supplies, and anything they have, including wedding rings, went to trying to make what they needed for the war. And so while Southern women start out at least as patriotic, some might argue more in the first years of the war, they can't sustain it. By the end of the war, their children are starving to death. Women in Richmond break into businesses to try to get flour for their, to make bread for their children. Do you know what Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, did, what he responded?
Threw this money out of his pocket here.
And then he said, if you don't go home, I'm getting the troops against you. He threatened the women with Confederate troops if they didn't stop this kind of behavior. And how long can you watch your child starve, right? They're writing letters to their husband, come home. And they're leaving, deserting in the last year of the war in just such high numbers. It's not because Southern men didn't want to fight or they were wimps or anything like that. They couldn't, so they were starving. And so when you put this all together, the Northern women who have access, and even when they run out, they find a way to get more money. And you take the Southern women who want to help but can't, and in the end start calling the men home, you have a legitimate and very significant reason that contributes to the